From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Rosanna Kim.
And I'm Sadie Rittman.
This week on War News Radio, Forward Thinking, we first discuss the future of Iraq in light of the 10-year anniversary this past March.
Then, we hear about a Philadelphia-based peace group protesting research on drone technology.
Finally, we hear a Rwandan genocide survivor's perspective on justice, forgiveness, and life in America.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
In the most recent series of threats from North Korea, the country has claimed that the Korean Peninsula is on the brink of a thermonuclear war due to threats of invasion by U.S. warmongers and South Korean puppets. The North stated that all foreigners in South Korea should leave the country to avoid being caught in any crossfire. North Korea has also announced plans to pull workers out of the Kaesong Industrial Complex, a factory jointly operated by North and South Korea. The South Korean government said the end of the Kaesong project would be a tremendous setback to South-North relations. Meanwhile, amidst concerns about whether the U.S. will take military action against North Korea, the Pentagon decided to delay intercontinental ballistic missile tests. A senior U.S. defense official said the tests might be misconstrued by some as suggesting that we were intending to exacerbate the current crisis with North Korea.
At least 19 people were killed after a car bomb exploded in the Syrian capital of Damascus this week, in the latest of a series of escalating rebel attacks throughout the business districts in the country. 53 others were injured in the blast. The violence came amid United Nations efforts to examine chemical weapons use in the Syrian conflict. The Syrian government requested that the UN visit the country to inspect an alleged chemical weapons attack this month by rebel forces near the city of Aleppo. Rebel groups, meanwhile, have claimed that this attack, as well as two others that occurred near Damascus and in Homs, were waged by the government. They, along with the French and British governments, have also asked the UN to investigate chemical weapons incidences across Syria. An advanced chemical weapons UN team has been waiting in Cyprus for the go-ahead from Syria to expand the weapons probe to all areas of the country. The Syrian Foreign Ministry, however, has denied the request. The government has now stated that, despite previous invitations, it will not allow any UN investigation team to enter the country because, they claim, such visits violate their sovereignty.
The United States Navy announced plans this week to deploy its newest weapon, a laser. The world's first real-directed energy weapon, the laser will be stationed in and deployed from a Navy ship. The laser reportedly has the capacity to disable enemy ships, as well as target and destroy drones. In the future, the Navy plans to expand the capabilities of the weapon to include disrupting any missile attacks. For the time being, however, the USS Ponce of the 5th Fleet has begun preparations to add the laser to its arsenal before it departs for the Persian Gulf next summer.
Tensions between Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi and the opposition leader Mohamed El-Baradei rose this week as sectarian violence in the country continued into its third day. The clashes began last week when a gunfight left four Christians and one Muslim dead in the town of Kusus, but reached a peak on Sunday as violence broke out between a large crowd of Muslims, Christians, and riot police outside Egypt's Coptic Christian Cathedral. Police fired tear gas into the cathedral and arrested 11 protesters for attacking the cathedral. Many in the crowd demanded the removal of President Morsi and the Islamist Party from power.
Since the beginning of the rebel movement in 2003, the Darfur region of Sudan has been the victim of constant violence. Over the past decade, 300,000 people have died, and approximately 2.7 million have been displaced. This trend continued this week, as the Mini-Manawi faction of the Sudan Liberation Army attacked and seized two towns in southern Sudan. The attack was in protest of a two-day conference in Doha, Qatar, focused on acquiring funds for the reconstruction and redevelopment of Sudan. International donors have thus far pledged $3.5 billion toward the effort.
This week, War News Radio reporter Varun Prasad wrote a post on our blog about the conflict in Mali. Varun is with me now to talk about what he learned from researching his piece. So Varun, what's the latest in Mali?
At the moment, the parties in the area are at a detente. However, this is purely because the French entered Mali in early January 2013. They provided air support as well as ground support to the Malian government in the region and have helped recapture several important cities in northern Mali from Islamist extremists, including Gao, Timbuktu, and Kidal. After this, the French government proposes to hand over control of the region to an African military force sometime in the near future. In fact, this was confirmed by French President Hollande when he visited Timbuktu on February the 2nd of this year.
So who exactly is involved in this conflict and how?
Besides the French government, there is the government of Mali, a one separatist group currently allied with the government of Mali, and three Islamist groups that they're fighting against. So the government of Mali is an interim government and the president is Diane Kounda Traoré. And currently the government is fighting against these three Islamist groups, the Ansar al-Din, the Movement for Jihad and Unity in West Africa, or the Mojwa, and the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in northern Mali.
So what's the next step in this conflict?
Now the next step is for the French troops to withdraw from Mali in the short run, perhaps in the next 2 months. I believe that March is the date that President Hollande and the defense minister of France proposed. And after that, control of the region will be handed over to an African military force as early as March.
This is War News Radio. The month of March marked the 10-year anniversary of the war in Iraq. War News Radio reporters Jay Clayton and Patrick Hahn interviewed two experts on the long-term effects of the American military action in Iraq and the country itself, wondering, in essence, what's next for Iraq. What they found was that the future of the country was not only highly uncertain, but also deeply tied to the war's beginning.
I was in a section that had 25 killed in the office of the Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel in the Pentagon. I was about as close to impact as one could be and still come out vertical. And I remember in the parking lot with the Pentagon burning, with chaos all around while we're accounting for survivors. And a senior officer said, Iraq is behind this. And I said, right, like Iraq was behind the Oklahoma City bombings.
That's Ralph Massey on his experience in the Pentagon on 9/11. Currently a professor at the University of Maryland, Massey has experience in the U.S. Armed Forces and as senior scientist for the RAND Corporation. He claims that President Bush came into office with the administration intent on an agenda.
People in key positions from Pearl to Wolfowitz to Fife were put there for a reason, and they had a compelling vision of remaking the Middle East that they intended to carry out. 9/11 was a license to steal.
According to Massey, senior intelligence officials couldn't believe that previously discredited intelligence was suddenly the justification for war. They couldn't figure out if the administration was being irrational or just downright dishonest.
A mixture between incompetence and dishonesty to make the case for the war.
Massey had a lot to say about the immediate causes of the war, but was more careful in his evaluation of the country's future.
But it's much, much too early to tell. I mean, history has yet to render a judgment on the long-term effects of the U.S.-led war with Iraq.
These effects, according to national security experts, include a destabilized political system, sectarian competition for limited power and resources, and pervasive insurgency. They point out that the war has also shaken the American public, its military leaders, and its policymakers. These analysts agree on one thing, that the future of Iraq is as cloudy as the conditions leading up to the invasion of Iraq 10 years ago. Massey is not alone in his uncertainty.
You know, look, I mean, the thing is I'm always hesitant to make a judgment on that. But frankly, it's a long-term judgment of history.
I'm not sure, right? I just can't be certain about that.
That was Nathan Fryer, former U.S. Army officer and professor at the U.S. Army War College, with extensive experience as a military strategist and senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Fryer is less than optimistic about the security situation of Iraq now and in the near future, asserting that Iraq will remain a relatively unstable and immature political entity for the foreseeable future.
There just are, you know, multiple competing interests inside that country for control of resources, for control of political authority.
Massey concurred.
I think it will continue to degrade.
Massey compared the current situation to post-war 1918 Germany, with sectarian violence very well developed between Shia, Sunni, and Kurd.
And you have sectarianism, extremism, you have wealth-amassing elites, but you have the regional powers as well, and it's too early to tell. I do think there's going to be something of a palpable and continuing descent into violence.
When it comes to the key players that will shape Iraq's destiny, Massey argues that intervention by the U.S. and Western powers like NATO will not be readily embraced by Iraq for a long time.
I think you could see something akin to what happened after the Soviets left Afghanistan, and that country turned into a hotbed of extremism. But I think we are so detested in that part of the world right now that an ability to go ahead and project our assistance into that part of the world is going to be strenuously resisted.
In fact, public opinion in the United States has historically been able to make or break military exploits abroad, and the invasion of Iraq may have implications for foreign interventions in the near future. U.S. decision-makers are going to be much more hesitant to undertake such a dramatic responsibility, removing and replacing a foreign regime.
I think there's going to be a great deal more self-deterrence and restraint on the use of military power, especially as it involves the physical employment of American forces in a foreign contingency abroad, that this is no longer, you know, an affordable military option for the United States.
There's no more doctrine of preventive war as there was after 9/11.
Having written an article in the Baltimore Sun entitled Iraq's Bitter Lessons, he believes that the duration and cost, both human and economic, will prevent the American public from being hoodwinked into another questionable military intervention abroad, at least within this generation.
I don't foresee American men and women dying in the Iranian desert.
Many obstacles still stand in the way of long-term democratization in Iraq. Among them are the deep-seated ethnic and religious divisions between Sunni and Shia, as well as those between Arab and Kurd. According to Fryer, voting purely on these ethnic and religious identifications undermines the healthy functioning of democracy. He speaks on the lack of separation between mosque and state.
In a country that, number one, doesn't have a tradition of democracy, and number two, has these deep sort of divisions within the society itself, that's a dodgy proposition.
With a past and present as complex as Iraq's, no one knows what lies ahead for this troubled nation. Whether Iraq is destined for democracy, oligarchy, or anarchy, only time will tell. In the short run, however, our experts agree that Iraq has a long way to go before we can fully reverse the debilitating damage it has suffered from both local and foreign sources of violence.
We have seen the end of the beginning in Iraq, but certainly not the beginning of the end.
Reporting for War News Radio, along with Jay Clayton, I'm Patrick Hahn.
This is War News Radio. For a certain kind of scientist, the best way to fund your research is to ask Uncle Sam. Among other sources, you can seek money from the National Science Foundation, the National Institutes of Health, or occasionally military sources like the Department of Defense. One peace group based outside of Philadelphia thinks funding from the military arms of the government are suspect, especially when the research has applications for unmanned aerial vehicles or drones. War News Radio's Amy DiPiero covers a protest against research at local universities and finds there's more to the story than this follow-the-money strategy.
It's just before noon on the first Saturday in April, and it finally feels like spring has come to Philadelphia. On the campus of the University of Pennsylvania, students in pastel-colored shirts linger outside a Starbucks on the corner of Walnut and South 34th. Across the street, an odd collection of protesters in black winter coats strikes a contrast to the Technicolor students. These are the members of the Brandywine Peace Community, along with a few of their allies from similar pacifist groups from in and around the city. This afternoon, like every other first Saturday of the month for the past 3 years, they are protesting U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia. More specifically, this weekend they're here on campus to create awareness about robotics research at UPenn and nearby Drexel University, research they say has applications in drone warfare. More is at stake than tinkering with flying robots in a lab. Since President Obama took office, 3,000 militants and civilians have been killed in these countries by U.S. attacks, most using drones. But where does UPenn's robotics lab get its research money? And are those funds really invested in killing machines? These protesters say yes, but most students barely give them a glance. Electrical and Engineering Systems grad student Sonia Roberts, however, is deep into a conversation with one member of this somber group. Her research is part of the larger General Robotics, Automation, Sensing and Perception, or GRASP, lab at Penn. If there's any Penn research tied to drones, it's here. Many of the lab's projects with unmanned aerial vehicles, drones to you and me, have received Defense Advanced Research Project Agency grants in the past, a fact Brandywine and others find suspect. DARPA, after all, is the research and development agency of the U.S. Department of Defense, although it's worth mentioning that much of the technology DARPA funds has applications beyond warfare. With that said, Roberts isn't sure protesting the university is the best way to change how research is applied by the military.
I can tell you, my lab does not have any DARPA grants right now. We've had DARPA grants in the past, but ultimately, DARPA is the major funder for a lot of these types of robotic research. They just are. We try to get, you know, funding from other sources when we can, because, of course, it makes people uncomfortable to know that, you know, the robots that you're building might be used for these applications, but ultimately, that still is a political issue. That's not a Penn issue. Like, we can do as much as we can.
It is a Penn issue if you're the recipients. I think as far as, you know, if you're looking at culpability and blame, that's not really where I'm going there. I guess it's more of, you know, more of a critical thought about, again, you know, the whole structure of funding.
But wrapped up in that is that a lot of the scary funding that's going towards the military, where we think, oh, we're building up this huge, terrible army that's going to go and crush third world countries, et cetera, a lot of that's actually just going towards robots that may not be evil.
Roberts doesn't work on the project that builds the miniature flying robots called quadrotors that have made GRASP infamous. But the same funding issues touch her corner of the lab, too. Around noon, the group dons white masks and prepares to march through a slice of campus. Today's action is called the Silent Death Walk and Kite Flying for Peace, a somewhat contradictory agenda. True to the title, though, after the masked protesters return from their march, they'll fly kites as a symbolic gesture in a nearby park. Today, there are about 30 protesters in all, ranging from a group of older activists called the Granny Peace Brigade to a young family with a dog and a child in a stroller. The march itself, as its name suggests, strives for silence. It's not until we return to the corner where we started that the real ruckus begins, complete with one member tolling a death knell. Pastel-shirted undergrads continue to pass without heed, but one student on his way to a fraternity barbecue confronts three members of the Granny Peace Brigade.
The thing is, the U.S. has this idea that they're fighting a war on terrorism, a war that I personally disagree with. I don't think that's a legitimate war. But at the same time, invoking the use of drones allows us to go about, like, progressing through that war without risking the lives of men and women who generously enlist themselves in the war.
You're the father, and your daughter is killed by a drone. How many of your family become terrorists after that incident?
Yes, that's fair enough. But you're also the father of your daughter who's now enlisted to go to Yemen, fight terrorists on the ground, and dies in suicide bombs in Yemen. Would you rather have, as an American citizen, would you rather have some machine in the air looking over the Yemeni population, or would you rather have your daughter in the trenches, in the ground, in Yemen, fighting against terrorists
the
and guerrilla warfare style?
It's really not an equal question.
The
drones go over and they target...
The student leaves unconvinced. Some of the organizers begin announcing the names of civilians who died in drone strikes, a list compiled by the independent nonprofit Bureau of Investigative Journalism.
Noor Syed, 8. Ali Shah, 7.
The thing is, at least from the perspective of scientists at Penn and Drexel, the connection between their research and civilian deaths by predator drones isn't clear at all. In an email message, Professor Vijay Kumar at GRASP, who many protesters see as the ringleader of the university's drone research, says his work can be applied to search and recovery missions, not to missions that target militants. It can be tough work parsing the scientific and defense jargon used to describe Kumar's projects, but they don't quite sound as innocent as he suggests. One of the collaborative projects he works on aims to create robots able, quote, to search for potential threats, identify them, track them, and take appropriate action to neutralize them. With that said, in videos posted on the GRASP website, Kumar's robots seem hardly more deadly than Brandywine's kites. They look like miniature helicopters, maybe the size of a hand, and all they can really do is hover and shift positions in unison. So far, the most damning thing they can do is play the James Bond theme song on carefully prepared instruments, perhaps a tongue-in-cheek homage to the technology's spying applications. After seeing the kite flyers off, I wandered over to the GRASP lab. It was empty but for a handful of students, and I asked them if they knew anything about the protesters. Sure, they said, they had seen them, but they're not going to change research objectives at UPenn, no matter how noble their intentions. For War News Radio, I'm Amy DePiro.
This is War News Radio. This month marks the 19th anniversary of the state-orchestrated genocide in Rwanda. In 1994, approximately three-quarters of the Tutsi population were killed in a span of 100 days. Today, Rwanda is making impressive strides in economy, stability, and rehabilitation. Average annual GDP growth is 7-8%. For one young genocide survivor, this progress is a source of pride and optimism. War News Radio's Sabrina Singh talks with Remy Monsi about his memories, hopes, and justice after genocide in this question and answer piece.
This month is the 19th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. I talked to Remy Monsi, a first year at the University of Pennsylvania, about his memories of genocide, his impressions of America, and the importance of justice and forgiveness. How do you remember the Rwandan genocide?
It was just like yesterday when we lost about a million people. My generation, the kids who survived the genocide, gathered together in roads all over Kigali and just think about what the genocide really meant. So right now, it's not the time to hold myself back as a genocide survivor.
How was life like before the genocide started?
I grew up in a very small family composed of my mother and my brother.
And how did life change after that?
You know, when the genocide started, when my mom heard on the radio that the attacks were coming, it was about 8 p.m. in the evening. She was sort of prepared, and she had packed everything together. And she, young as I was, only 4 years old, brother almost 6, gave us these huge things. My brother holding these luggages, my mom holding these sacks of beans. Rains pouring outside. We left, and we had to go and find the refuge. And lucky enough, we found the refuge in a Catholic camp.
What do you remember of the Catholic camp?
The situation was quite tragic because my brother and I had a very strong, severe sicknesses of nose bleeding, headaches, diarrhea. Kids started dying, not through attacks or anything, but because of this malnutrition problem. Women were giving birth all the time in front of their kids.
Manzi and his mother miraculously evaded Hutu attackers and fled to the north. He enrolled in a school program that eventually helped him apply to school here in America. I asked how his mother reacted when he got into the University of Pennsylvania.
And she just couldn't believe it. She never knew what Ivy League means. I barely knew what it means also, but she knew I was coming to America. And America in Rwanda represents opportunity.
Is your expectation of America as the land of opportunity fulfilled?
The work ethics in America is just ridiculous. One of the things that I really want to take back to Rwanda is the believing in this work ethic.
What sorts of questions did people ask when you first came to America?
I just laughed. There's one young girl I met, and she was like, "Where are you from?" And I said, "I'm from Rwanda." "Oh, Hotel Rwanda. And please, give me this opportunity to mention that Hotel Rwanda is not accurate. My cousin of mine and two of her friends passed away because they wanted a place to stay at Mill Colleen. My cousin and her friends, these are emotional things that my family remembers. But when we see how they are portrayed, when we see how these movies try to form false things, we are just haunted.
One of the contentious issues after the genocide has been that of justice. The Rwandan government started traditional community courts in each village to persecute perpetrators of the genocide. This system, called Gacaca, ended last year after bringing nearly 2 million people to trial. How do you remember Gacaca in your own neighborhood?
So what the government had to do, had to start up Gacaca courts. They moved in different districts all over the country to select these integral men, give them initial legal practice and legal education, very, very basics, and then send them back to the community to judge these cases in presence of the survivors, my mom, myself, my brother. We attended a Gacaca court. This happened every Sunday of every week.
So the people who are accused don't go to prison, but they go back to building community and building infrastructure?
These perpetrators go back home to where they killed the people and build houses for the survivors.
So do you think the Gacaca courts are fair?
100% fair, because these are the judges that are no strangers to us.
Do you have any hatred or any anger toward the perpetrators?
Personally, I don't have any anger to the perpetrators. My mother also had to testify on her friends that died, who she was very close to. On the cases that she has testified, three of the men are now doing community building services. And the happy news is one of the men is helping her farm his pig farm, which is just a beautiful story. To see a person who committed these crimes, who's very open-hearted to ask for forgiveness each single day. She's working on the fields with my mom. This is just one story in millions in Rwanda.
This was the story of Remy. This summer, he's taking some of his American friends back home and someday hopes to work for the government of Rwanda. For War News Radio, this is Sabrina Singh.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew for this week includes Eliana Biscard-Church, Jay Clayton, Sarah Morell, Allison Ranshaus, Colin Smith, Tyler Welsh, and Chloe Wittenberg. For War News Radio, I'm Sadie Rittman.
And I'm Rosanna Kim. Until next time, thanks for listening.